What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm your host, Damien Galvin, and I'm joined by Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun. As always, I'm the co-host of the Polititeen podcast. We at Polititeen try to spark conversation, healthy political conversation between young Americans and young Georgians here today. And today with us, we have a very special guest, Charles Ravenscraft. He's running for representative from District 22 in Georgia. So, Charles, I hand it off to you to kind of talk about yourself.
Hey, everyone. My name is Charles Ravenscraft. Like they said, I'm running for state representative in District 22. That area kind of covers the eastern part of Cherokee County, a little bit of Forsyth, a little bit of North Fulton. A little bit about my background. I'm a union electrician. Have been a union organizer and various other activist type roles. That about covers my basics.
That's awesome to hear. And I guess my first question for you, as we ask all of our guests on the podcast, you know, you've lived in Georgia ever since 1986. So, you know, what inspired you to join the political field to become a candidate for Georgian House?
I've always been involved in politics, even as a young kid. My dad had instilled it in me. I am not in the political party that I started out as. I was raised to be a Republican, and I changed parties about 10 years ago. For running here, I ran in 2018, and a lot of why I wanted to run is there's not really been many Democrats run in this area. And I feel that you should always be properly represented and should be given a choice. If you don't even have a choice in a party or a group of people or a person to be able to vote for, then you're not even living in a proper democracy anymore. It's becoming an autocracy. So that was the main reason why I decided to start running, was to at least give people a chance and a choice and a different candidate if they so chose.
Nice. So I guess my first question then would be, why did you decide to switch political parties?
Even growing up, I was always very socially liberal. I remembered even being pro-choice, or not pro, yeah, I was pro-choice in high school. A lot of issues that I believed in socially, I was liberal on. And so the turning point kind of came. I joined the union back in 2009, actually swore in the same day Obama did. And we started having issues in the state legislature where they were trying to pass laws that were curbing the already limited abilities of unions down here. And it's then I finally clicked and said, you know, I don't have anything in common with this party anymore. And now they, you know, now that this is personal to me and my paycheck and my way of taking care of my family, and I look back on everything else, and I said, I've not had anything in common with this party for years. So why would I even still try to say I'm part of this? So that's what caused me to switch.
Right. And you mentioned yourself as a member, a former member, and a current member of a labor union and a former union electrician. So I guess my next question for you, Charles, is...
Well, I'm a current union electrician, but...
Oh, you are? Like, awesome. That's awesome to hear. Awesome. So I guess my next question for you is, you know, you're committed to kind of being a voice for working class families. So if you're elected, what kind of policies do you plan on implementing to increase the socioeconomic status of these families?
First and foremost, we need to raise the minimum wage in the state of Georgia. The current minimum wage in the state of Georgia is $5.15 an hour. And yes, the federal wage is higher, and that is the more accepted, you know, used an accepted standard. The Georgia minimum wage only applies to about 3% of the population. But at the same time, even at the federal level, $7.25 doesn't cut it. We have too much working poor going on in this state. So we need to raise the minimum wage in this state. I'm a strong supporter of the $15 an hour minimum wage, but willing to work with anything to get it more closer to livable. We also need to see a cost of living increase that's added to the minimum wage annually. So that way we don't get in a position where we haven't raised the minimum wage in a decade and now we're stuck with a problem of, well, if you raise it too quickly, too much, then that's going to cause a strain on businesses. If we, you know, make it progressive and work along with it, then it's not such a hit. The other main issue, and this is sad to say that I'm having to basically run on the same issues I did in 18, is expanding Medicaid. We are one of the states that did not expand Medicaid with the ACA. And what that has created is a lot of, especially in the rural areas where Medicare, medical is not nearly, is not available to the people. And it causes strains on people. When you're not sick or when you're sick and you can't get to a doctor, you can't take, you know, take care of yourself, you can't pay for the insurance, it all rolls downhill. It affects your work, it affects your household. Everything is tied to healthcare anymore. And in all honesty, I believe it's ridiculous that our healthcare is tied to our employment anyway. It really restricts our freedom in our job pursuits when it's restricted to healthcare. And my third main thing that I've run on, this is kind of for the future, is I want to see a statewide vocational curriculum in the high schools to actually better prepare people coming out of school for jobs like what I do. For the jobs that everybody's kind of forgotten about that exist and are still good paying jobs, and making it to where you're more prepared, because not everybody is going to want to go to college. Not everybody is equipped to go to college. So right. instead of pushing this narrative that's going to put you in debt after you're done with going to a school where you're hoping for a $40,000 a year job, if we get people prepared in vocationals, then you can start in the workforce right away and already start making good money and not have to be in crippling debt for your entire adult life.
Well, yeah, that's an amazing point. And you bringing up the point, especially, of coming straight out of college and being able to have a job, reminded me of the fact that there's a lot of frontline workers out there that we kind of undermined before this whole coronavirus situation. And we just kind of took them for granted. And it's a community that we definitely need to appreciate a lot more. But with that being said, I kind of want to bring in the topic of the virus, and especially, you know, in the state of Georgia, how the cases just seem to be going up. What has been your kind of thought process throughout the whole situation from the start of the quarantine, the lockdown, to when we ended it? We were one of the first states to start reopening. What's kind of been going through your mind the whole time?
Okay, first of all, the quarantine, in my opinion, was kind of a joke. I never stopped working.
Yeah.
I mean, and I am on the federal list of essential workers. And granted, I understand and I respect that in certain cases. But like the first job I was working on when the quarantines were first starting was a restaurant that wouldn't even be able to be opened until after this was all done anyway. So I actually talked with some representatives and I was like, why is this a thing? Why am I still out here working in Fulton County at that time, you know, kind of in the epicenter of everything, on something that's not essential? Now we did have a bunch of guys working down at Grady Hospital still putting together after the flood. That's essential. That's important to have done and have ready for all this. But I think that this everything that happened that has happened after the quarantine ended, so to speak, was premature. It's showing to be premature. And it's not beneficial to anybody. It hadn't been beneficial to anybody, and I think if anything, it put a strain on the working class people, and especially the essential workers, non-medical related, and even the medical related fields as well. A lot could have been done differently. A lot should be done differently. It's still not too late to address this issue and not have, you know, your head in the sand over it, which seems to kind of be the way I've seen it going on right now.
Right. And I guess I wanted to ask you about another kind of virus that we've had in our nation for centuries, and that virus is global warming. You know, mm-hmm. we're reaching almost 1.5 degrees Celsius in climate change. And I guess I wanted to ask you, myself and Damien talk about this a lot. You know, we talk about how we have to make a feasible platform to advance and to prevent ourselves from reaching 2 degrees Celsius in global warming. So being an advocate for workers and working class families, what do you think is a solution to kind of decreasing the amount of strain that global warming has on our communities? And how does that involve workers? Because a lot of people are saying that we can't move forward without alienating workers.
Yeah, that's kind of a misnomer and a misrepresentation. On the one hand, I do understand and see that point. One of the biggest ones that I kind of stand in opposition with the party on a little bit is like Plant Vogtle with nuclear power. I have worked in Plant Vogtle. I've worked in another nuke. I've worked in coal burners, gas, and solar. And I do think that nuclear is a good segue to going to 100% renewable. But right. Like right now at Vogtle, if we were to shut down the Vogtle build, that would be 5,000 people out of work just for that site, not including all the residual outside business and economy that gravitates around it. But there is so much that can be done, and like the Green New Deal kind of outlines it. We can shift the workers over to these jobs. To different green jobs, putting in solar, putting in wind. Hydroelectric is one that I've always been interested in. There are so many different jobs that can be shifted over and we can adjust that it wouldn't really hurt the workers. It would help, in my opinion, the economy, because we really need to work on the infrastructure, and it needs to be a green infrastructure, because the infrastructure we're sitting on now is already decaying out from under us. So right. Let's go ahead and while we need to fix it anyway, let's go ahead and make it in a more climate friendly means. So I don't see it really hurting the workers too much in the long term now.
Well, you know, we're talking about a Green New Deal here, and I guess I haven't directly looked into Georgia's policy here, but when people hear Green New Deal, they typically tend to point to it as radical. What would you say in response to anyone that's saying that these policies are radical?
I always find that interesting, because, you know, the progressive wing and, you know, the radicals, which I consider myself progressive, we talk about something and we fight for something that was in existence already in this country. We had a president like this. It was FDR, and he was so popular he got elected 4 times, and he did so many radical things to try to pull our country out of the Great Depression and whatnot, and things that now by today's definition would be, you know, the socialist thing of, you know, Social Security, all these things. So yes, it does seem radical, but it's not really all that radical. It's things that have already been talked about before in certain instances, and it just needs to be done. And, you know, change is scary. Yeah, I get it. But just because it's scary doesn't mean you can't look at it and you can't try to make it happen.
Right. I agree 100%. You know, we have to move forward in our nation. But I guess I wanted to talk to you about another thing that we have to move forward on, and that infects our nation and infiltrates our population, month after month after month, and that is, you know, gun control. So what is your stance on gun control and how we should target these kind of instances and you know, make guns, I guess, more regulated and things like that?
I hate using the phrase gun control. I use gun responsibility. Gun control does give that connotation of fear that I'm going to sit here and send the police out to come take all your guns away. That's not a reality. But what we do need is we need red flag laws. There does need to be an accountability with firearms and guns. If you are in a if there's a situation, you have someone, and I hate to say even accused of domestic violence at this point, then they need to surrender their guns until it's adjudicated. If you have somebody who is deemed mentally a hazard to themselves or a danger to others, they need to surrender their weapons. The shooting in Nashville at the Waffle House was a case of red flag laws gone wrong. The kid that killed the four people had his guns confiscated in Illinois under their red flag laws, and they gave the guns to his father, and the father turned around and gave them right back to the kid, and now there are four people dead. So we definitely need to go in that direction of things. Other things, I do believe in bump stocks need to be banned. And I think I think that guy that sits in a White House did work to move towards that. I didn't see if that actually finalized or not. You know, high capacity magazines, I think if you can't do it in 10 shots, then you're a terrible shot, first of all. And that's you know, if you can't defend yourself in 10 shots or less, you're doing something wrong. There's things that you can do to help control and not really control, but help keep accountability. You know, having the universal background checks. I think if a kid commits a crime with a gun and they're under 18, the parent, and it's deemed that it's a parent's gun, the parent needs to be held responsible too. They need to sit in that courtroom right next to that kid.
Yeah.
Because they fail to maintain the responsibility of gun ownership.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you. I think 1,000%. I've always been kind of questionable on the aspect of a parent being held responsible for the gun ownership. But as I've kind of grown to see everything else, obviously I've been involved in politics since a young age. But as I've grown to see everything else, it's very reasonable that if you own something, you should be responsible for how that's used and who has access to it. Now, this is a thought that I've had a long time, and we've talked about gun control here on the podcast, but do you think, and this might sound a little bit weird, but do you think that the technology of weapons needs to be invested into? And what I'm trying to say here is, do we need to understand how we can better use weapons or how we can better control the use of weapons? For example, blocking, you know, being able to locate weapons on a stance, or be able to take away weapons or disable weapons, kind of like, you know, at first you had police chases, and now you can have police officers turn off someone's car from their vehicle. Do you think that that's something that we can look into in the future?
Maybe in the future, something to look at. Now, I would argue that's getting a little big brother. But I know they are working on technology, like basically a fingerprint scan grip, to where if it's not the registered finger, the gun won't fire. I've heard of those, that technology getting developed. So, I mean, I can respect technology kind of being developed to help curb it, like in that manner of, you know, specialty scanned grips and whatnot. But you know, we as society kind of evolved, so down the line where we see it if we see it necessary, then we can explore it. Yeah,
right. And I think that, you know, on the topic of kind of gun control and and things like that. There's also something that's very more contemporary with our society. And obviously we're having racial tensions across the nation with BLM protesters and people like that rioting for more racial justice. So I guess I wanted to ask you next, you know, how do we promote a community of equality and of acceptance within District 22? Because, you know, we've been seeing concerns and cries for that across the nation. So how do we do better?
Right. So down in Woodstock, I went for a week solid, but we actually had up to 200 people down in downtown Woodstock of various races and whatnot protesting for, I think they might even still, some of them still be going out there protesting every day.
Right.
And we're getting pretty good reception from everybody. We even had support from the fire department and from the police department there. It was very cohesive, everything. You know, I've had a couple little problems there, but nothing on the grand scale. And nobody trying to incite violence or anything down there. One of the things I find interesting, like having part of Forsyth County, I grew up in Stone Mountain, Georgia. And I, you know, for the most part, grew up in an African American community. Though, you know, it wasn't when we first moved there, but by the time I left, it had. And I remember Forsyth County, even, you know, back in the 90s, and we talked about a sign in Forsyth County, and everybody knew about this sign, and it basically was in effect saying that, you know, if you're not white, don't come in here and don't be here after dark. The one precinct I won in 2018, I mean, was in Forsyth County. Forsyth County is drastically starting to change, especially in southern, like around the Halcyon Village and whatnot. It's getting more diverse. There's a lot more tolerance, a lot more acceptance. But one of the biggest things to kind of really answer the question more properly, we actually have to sit down in the community and actually listen to the grievances. That was kind of one of my bigger frustrations being at the protest, was didn't really see elected officials coming down to talk to anybody. Well, if you want to govern somebody, you need to talk to them. Whether you agree with them or not, you have to at least sit down and have the conversation and find out what's the side of the story. What do they see? Because I can't tell another person what they should think or how they should feel. You know, I can't, and as a white person, I can't tell a black person how they should view how things are going. That's not how it works. Everybody sees things differently. So, but we need to be able to sit down and actually have the conversations about it. And I think it's getting closer. This is, I've seen this kind of over the past 30 years. I've kind of watched these flare up here and there. And this one felt different. This one has definitely felt like maybe we are going to actually step in the right direction. But I guess time will tell.
Yeah, hopefully time will tell, and racial justice will prevail for everyone. But usually we focus here on local stuff when we bring on local candidates, and with that being the case, I'm not sure if you're aware of the situation that took place in front of the Forsyth County Courthouse. But for those who aren't aware that are listening, and if you aren't, during the protest and the heat of the protests, a student of a Forsyth County school decided to drive by and yell provocative slurs, and he said F them, and then said some racial slurs to the protesters there. Now at Politatine, we decided to take a stance, and we created a petition, and we're trying to do all we can to make that deed right, and to make sure that everyone feels safe inside of Forsyth County schools. So I guess my question for you here is, what do you think? I personally think that education in those circumstances for the person that was involved or the person that committed the act is what we need to work on cultural acceptance and cultural diversity training and lessons for the students or for adults for that matter. What is your solution for people who have committed these acts? Obviously, there's no hate crime bill here in Georgia, but what's your proposal?
There is now. They just signed it into law
today.
One of the things that I had was basically I had to learn, because how I grew up, we had some issues, was to actually sit down and talk and yes, educate, but it also kind of takes the person to have to open up and want to listen. I mean, yes, there should be in schools a racial sensitivity training or lectures or whatnot to kind of make the kids understand a little bit better. Because one, you're not born racist, you're not born prejudiced. You learn it, and when you're young, who you learn it from? You're gonna learn it from your parents or somebody bigger than you or older than you that is spouting these things off. So in the schools, that's kind of a way for the adults to be able to kind of steer how you should think, or not how you should think, but how you think. So yeah, if you do some sensitivity classes in schools, even just having in community rooms in the county and, you know, the libraries or whatnot, you know, have a racial justice forum on a Saturday or whatnot. You know, have these round tables where you can kind of sit down and talk about what's, you know, what is going on and actually hear it. Because that's part of the problem too, is if you never see or understand, you know, where another person's coming from, then you got blinders on and you don't really, you know, you don't see beyond what's outside your front door.
Right. And the goal that we have here at Politateen is to raise conversation and discussion within our community about political issues, and to make people more educated and more willing to discuss things instead of having a set mindset about them. Now, that said, we're nearing the end of our podcast and interview with you here today, Charles. So I guess I wanted to ask you, as we always ask our candidates before they hop off of our podcast, you know, if you could say one thing to a young listener and a young voter in this next election, what would you say, you know, about your campaign and about the future?
That's a pretty good question. I would say pay attention and ask the questions and, you know, do the research. And be engaged in politics, be engaged in your community, because you matter. And, you know, just because you have to wait till you're 18 to vote doesn't mean that when you're 16, you don't matter. Legislators and the government makes decisions that affect you, even though you can't do anything about it in the voting booth. But at the same time, you still matter. You can still get out there, use your voice, and speak out. But that's what I would say is be engaged, because someday I'm going to be older. Someday y'all are in charge, and I want to make sure that the younger generations are as properly equipped to take over, better equipped to take over and handle things than I was handed it, you know. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, I mean, an extremely powerful message to end off on. Obviously, something that we try to focus here on the podcast, with us especially not being able to vote yet, not reaching that age of 18. But I want to thank you for coming on. You had some very insightful things to say, and you gave me a different perspective onto different issues, and I think Varun can say the same. Yep. But with that being said, we're going to take a quick message from our sponsors, and be sure to stay tuned afterwards as me and Varun discuss. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. I think that went absolutely amazing, Varun. We were talking about it during the little break here. I absolutely love that. I love having guests on. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I have to agree. I think that Charles brought a different perspective than our previous, you know, people we had on the podcast. He's very progressive. You know, he's a person who I respect a lot for his policies and for his kind of transformation from being a Republican to a Democrat. It's something that I really, really believe in. Because as we speak about time and time again on the podcast, the way to move forward is in a bipartisan manner. You know, we have to put aside our political background and how we were born and think about what we really believe in as Americans and make that decision for ourselves.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that it's also important to say kind of that it's good to also make the switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party if that's where your ideals really fall. And I think that it's important to look at where your ideals fall and fit into the party there than look at where the party's ideals fall and adjust. I think that's something that needs to happen more, and more political changes and the switches between parties need to be had.
Yeah, I believe in that very strongly. You know, because as a person, I often compare religion to politics because it's what I practice and I preach. You know, for me, it might be different than you, all of our viewers here, but I believe strongly that politics is very important. And, you know, as a Hindu, you know, I've been born as a Hindu, but when I reach the age of 18, I'm going to make that decision for myself. So I'm going to look at other religions and other cultures and see which one I really believe in. And I believe that I can move forward. So I think religion and politics should be approached the exact same way. We should look at different kind of approaches and kind of use our conscience instead of use our background to kind of gauge where we want to go.
Yeah, and even if the approach and the decision isn't made, you know, I'm kind of in the same boat as you. I was born and raised a Catholic, and obviously I get to make the decision for myself now. But I think the approach should also be that regardless of whether I choose to become a Catholic or I fall into another religion or I proceed to no religion, that the change also needs to be had and the voice also needs to be had and the listening needs to be had, especially when it comes to other religions or other beliefs. And I think that needs to apply both in religion and in politics. But moving on from that point, you know, we were talking about healthcare with Charles. Something interesting, I don't know if you saw earlier today, but Trump wants to ban the Obamacare in these times.
Yep. I did see that. I saw it actually, as I always see things on Twitter and on social media. He asked the Supreme Court to strike down the Affordable Care Act that Obama implemented to kind of make affordable health care for all Americans. And I think that it comes at the worst time possible, Damien, because we're having so many Americans who are, first of all, you know, who don't have insurance and proper health care. But second of all, we have African-Americans, almost 20% of African-Americans not have sufficient health care. And I was hoping you'd bring this up because I wanted to talk about how there's a huge divide and a gap between health care for the wealthy and the poor and for Black minorities versus the white majority. I think that what I've been reading, and I've been reading multiple studies and research and analytics, and what I've seen is that the most low-income Black communities get the worst healthcare at the highest rates, which is absolutely abominable. And without healthcare insurance, it's going to be even more worse for these people. I've been a strong believer, as you know, in healthcare as a human right. And I think that Trump striking down the ACA kind of just hits at my base. You know, it hits at what I believe in as an American. And it hits at the whole BLM movement, even though some might not realize it.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think, you know, always an interesting perspective is the whole argument on whether healthcare should be a human basic right or a basic human right. I don't know. I just think that it's funny to think that, you know, someone could like walk in and be dying and people would be like, yeah, you don't have insurance. You know, sorry about the gun wound through your chest. You actually have to go to the hospital next door to get that solved. I don't know. It's just kind of ridiculous. I feel like everyone should be able to receive basic human basically. It's like being denied water. If someone comes and knocks on your door, not giving them a bottle of water, it's just kind of ridiculous, and it's common courtesy. And I think also the switch is being had, and it's people are becoming less and less courteous. Obviously, we saw especially in these protests, people are becoming less and less courteous and less willing to listen. And in some respects they are, but there's also some spikes of people becoming more self-centered, I guess, or more selfish, or kind of just not caring about people. Obviously, you had his name, honestly horrible, but it slips out of my head. The guy who was passed out at the Wendy's that they burned down here in Atlanta. Was it Rashard?
Brooks.
Okay.
It's interesting that we forgot that. You know, it's been almost, I don't know if it's been a couple of weeks, but we forgot his name. And it goes to show that we've becoming immune to the kind of crises that have been happening on a nationwide scale. We forgot his name. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I only brought it up to show that, you know, in that circumstance, if I saw someone pass out in their car, why would I call the cops? You know, the first thing I would do personally is knock on their window, you know, obviously, you know, inform the police, but I wouldn't just inform the police, get my burger and leave. I want to make sure that person's okay, because they're also a human being. So I don't know. It's just this whole climate. It's kind of gross in the sense that people aren't really caring about each other anymore. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so you bring up a very valid point in that one thing I do have to disagree with you on is that hospitals, most hospitals, over 90% of hospitals, they can't deny patients emergency medical care. So, you know, they can't deny them if they're coming in as a dying patient. But what they can do is charge them millions of dollars in copays and in treatment costs. So I think that the problem here lies in that the people are being kind of treated in a proper way. But first of all, there's discrimination in healthcare. And second of all, they're going to be bombarded for the rest of their lives with these monetary expenses and constantly kind of have these money expenses thrown at them, which really makes a life not worth living, you know, having so much burden on your back. And we talk about this a long time ago, I believe, on the podcast, you know, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I think that somebody not having insurance is something that cannot go unnoticed within America, because even the smallest injury, and not a dying patient, the smallest injury can amount to thousands upon thousands of dollars in medical bills, which is simply not okay for low-income communities and low-income Americans.
Yeah, for sure. And you kind of knocked me back on my train of thought there with the thousands and thousands of dollars. I think that I was bringing up greed and I completely forgot where I was going with it. But the reason that I was bringing up greed is because I feel like a lot of these corporations are greedy. And what I mean is, like, yeah, $10,000 for an x-ray. It's like, why? You know, I understand that the machine's extremely expensive, but how many x-rays do you do a day? If you charged, you know, $5 for all the x-rays that you did, I'm pretty sure you could have whatever you paid for the machine back in a couple years. I just don't get why the prices are so egregious. It's weird. I feel like the corporations that make these things overcharge. I feel, I don't know. It's very, you know, obviously capitalism has extreme benefits. And I can't deny that. I'm not saying that we should be communist in any sense, but like, this is kind of one of the circumstances where capitalism kind of seems gross.
I say that capitalism seems gross is kind of, it's very accurate to describe our circumstance in terms of healthcare. I think that, you know, it's a really, really disturbing thing to see that corporations are kind of making that decision on how much money is kind of charged to patients. And what I was saying earlier, and I'm going to bring it up once again on the topic of what you're saying, is the fact that the hospitals that charge the most are in the most low-income areas. So the people in America who are making the least amount of money and are usually minorities are paying the most for their healthcare. So it shows a very big divide in how corporations, and especially healthcare corporations, are regarding human beings, because they simply show no regard for life and for the pursuit of happiness, as we're mentioning, for the American people. And I guess I wanted to switch the topic. We've been talking about healthcare for a hot minute here. I wanted to switch the topic to something that is hot in both of our minds since the last episode, and that is the Trump rally in Arizona. So I don't know if you saw the Trump rally and his speech to young voters, but how do you feel about what Trump said during that rally?
Well, I think he's just saying stupid stuff again. I'm trying to really just avoid what he's saying, because I feel like in a sense it's just negative and it's just stupid. I think that obviously it's important to hear what your politicians are saying, but I'm not hearing anything different, and he's not going up there and he's not telling me, hey, this is my plan for 2020. This is, you know, I messed up here. I'm going to do this different. This is my policy. He's just going up there and saying racist stuff. And he's going up there and saying dumb stuff. And he's going up there and trying to defend himself. But the thing that caught my eye the most was that they called it a successful rally with only 3,000 people showing up. And obviously the venue was the size of three. The venue sold out. But it's still 3,000 people is like nothing. That's like me going, you know, I'm selling out arenas, and the arena that I'm selling out is like 100 people in my backyard. Like, technically, yes, but it's not really what a president's supposed to be selling out.
Absolutely. And I was watching the rally and his speech during the rally. And in the beginning, I was like, you know, he's boasting about his overall ratings on Fox News, which is kind of what I expected from the president. And then he starts talking about some really dumb things. You know, he's talking about how, and it's weird to say it now that I'm talking about it on the podcast, but he's saying that it's something along the lines of Republicans being better looking than Democrats.
I have to agree with him.
and hate, you know, he's saying the Republicans look better than Democrats, which I don't understand, you know. We're all humans, you know. There's no divide between how Republicans look and how Democrats look. It's simply oblivious, and it made me laugh. It made me laugh. And another thing I wanted to kind of mention was the fact that later on, something very serious happened. And you go up and you talk about Trump going up and saying stupid things, dumb things, like Republicans looking better than Democrats. And what he said after that was that Democrats allow illegal immigrants to vote in the election so they can win local and nationwide elections. And it went from something that was funny and pleasing for me to laugh at, and maybe offensive to some, to something that was a straight lie.
Yeah, go ahead. If you want to finish off. I thought you were done there, but go ahead.
You're good.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I think the thing is, Varun, that it's gotten to the point where you know, there's a quote, it's hard to argue with a smart person, but it's impossible to argue with someone who's dumb. And yeah. I think it just applies. I think if at this point you still believe what Donald Trump is saying, that, you know, with respect to my fellow Americans, like, if you believe it, there's one thing to support him and to just support his policies. But if you actually believe what he's saying at this point, it's dumb. And in a sense, you're dumb. You're being brainwashed. So I guess my hope lies, and the reason that it's kind of just rolling off my shoulders now, is because I'm happy to see that Americans are kind of waking up and they're just saying, hey, this guy's an idiot. We messed up in 2016 and we're going to vote him out. And the reason that I say that is because in the states that he won, and landslide states, landslide in terms that they were major in him winning the election in 2016, Joe Biden is crushing him. I mean, crushing him. Like, this might be one of the biggest, not upsets in the terms of, this might be the, like, one of the biggest landslide victories. I don't care if they're voting for, personally, I think that Joe's only going to, you know, run for, I think, you know, maybe 4 years, and then he might retire or something like that. I don't think that he's going to be the Democratic president for 8 years. I think that would be way too long for him. But I think that he's just going to be the placeholder for another Democratic candidate. But I think it's just good. It just feels good to see that he goes up there and he says, you know, the Kung Flu. He always goes up. He says the Kung Flu like if he just hit like a target, and he just hit like an exactly. Ace. He just hit a three-pointer from half court. Like,
he says the Kung Flu more than he says Sleepy Joe Biden.
Yeah, I know. I really – it's just odd. And all you can do is laugh at it, because the people that are going to believe him are going to believe him. And I think, thankfully, America has kind of woken up to his ignorance. At this point, he's just saying really stupid stuff. In the beginning, he was saying stupid stuff, but it was stupid stuff that in a sense made – sense, sort of, you know, like we're gonna build the wall, illegal immigrants commit crime. Yes, they do commit crime. That's not like a statistic, that's like any human commits crime. You know, drain the swamp, okay, you can make up that. The coal miners, you can make up that. But here he's just saying stuff that isn't true, and I think people are just paying attention to it.
I have to agree. I think that in this election, in the beginning, 2016, he ran for actual policies, you know, actionable things that he said he would deliver upon. But right now he's running simply as a re-election president and nothing else.
Yeah.
He's running exactly on the same policies that he ran on four years ago. And there's really nothing much major that has changed in his overall policies. But I wanted to kind of say something that caught my eye. I don't know if it caught anybody else's eye, because I didn't see it reported on news channels or on Twitter as much as I thought it would be. But Trump mentioned his supporters in the rally, you know, young Republicans as the elite. The elite, it was his word choice. And it kind of reminded me of a lot of white Americans today and in past decades, past centuries, thinking of themselves as the elite. And it's not what he meant. I don't think so. But yeah. In saying that, it kind of reminded me of how we've been so divided upon these lines of I'm Republican and I'm Democrat that we've forgotten that we're all human beings and we're all Americans above everything else. Mm-hmm. We have to be patriots to our country over patriots to our party.
Yeah, I think that in a sense we have forgotten, but I think that the people that are forgetting are, again, these older people that are kind of, in a sense, you know, I hate to say it about fellow Americans, but in a sense they're brainwashed and they stand and they just can't listen. I think that our generation, honestly, is doing really good. I think that I have a lot of hope in how we're going to listen to each other. Obviously, you know, especially with Will, you know, it's awesome to be able to have a conversation on these issues today. And hopefully it's going to change. And it's not just going to be identity politics. It's something that I talk about all the time. On the first date, when someone asks, who are you or what are you like? What do you like to do? You're not going to mention that you're Republican or Democrat at first. And if you do, then obviously you're doing something wrong with your politics. I think that we're going to make a change, and I think that it's going to be good. And I think that we are starting to remember in this time that we are humans. But it's upsetting to see a president divide in a sense. Yeah. You know, he just divides. He just divides, and he crushes, and he doesn't really care. He just says stupid stuff. The reason I bring this up is because I wanted to bring up Mike Pence, and I have to give a round of applause to Mike Pence. You know, he might be saying BS, but at least Mike Pence was saying BS that kind of brought us together as Americans. And what I'm referring to is earlier today they had another a COVID whatever the team, the press conference. And you know, he went out there and he said, you know, all the states are trying to do their best to reopen. I didn't like that CNN said that, well, technically some states are going back on the reopening. I think what Pence was trying to say was that they're trying to make progress nonetheless of how that progress is going. You know, he didn't go up there and say anything political. He didn't say that it was the Chinese fault. He didn't say this. He didn't say that, which I would have expected Donald Trump to go up and do. He just went up and tried to heal the nation and told them, hey, you know, the thing that empowered me the most is he said one American death is too many. But thankfully, we went from 3 weeks ago having 2,500 deaths to last week only having 300. It's still too many, but we're making progress. And that you can't deny that. You can't deny that they're trying, and it makes you feel better.
I think that I have to disagree, Damien, on that stance about what Mike Pence said earlier, more recently. I think that he was painting a very deceptive and rosy picture that was not reality. Because I'm reading up on Twitter and on CNN, on Real Clear Politics, some really bipartisan websites. And what they're saying, and even on fact-checking websites, is that he was painting the wrong picture. Because if you look at the statistics for the COVID-19 cases and how they've been doing, deaths have decreased. I'll give him that. But the number of cases has gone on an upward spike ever since the beginning of June. So we hit a plateau in April and May, and they decreased ever since then. But in the beginning of June, we've seen a huge, huge, huge spike upwards in cases. And he's not mentioning that, because I think that in a sense, we as Americans have to move forward and grow and go outside more and return back to daily life. But older Americans have to be wary of the threat that continues and still exists, because they're at the highest risk. And if we're telling these older Americans that there's no threat and that cases are decreasing steadily, we have to also tell them that deaths are decreasing, but cases are increasing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Mike Pence, I don't think that Mike Pence said that the cases were decreasing. I don't know if he did. Would you be willing to correct me on that?
He never mentioned the cases.
Okay, well, yeah, and I think that it's, in a sense, you know, he didn't mention it, but he's being a politician. He's not going to mention something that blurs his image. But what Trump would have done was, Trump would have said, the cases aren't increasing, and it's fake news, and it's this, it's that. He would have tried to blame someone, and that's what I'm trying to say here. You know, Pence, maybe he played the politician, but right now the politician is what we need. The guy that lies to us without us knowing that he's lying to us. And you know, it sounds gross to say, but we need it. We need, America needs to be unified, and America needs these, in a sense, you know, hate to say it, they're white lies because of the fact that he's not necessarily lying. He's just not mentioning the whole truth. And obviously that can be catastrophic, but I think right now we just need this unification. Obviously, you know, you were mentioning the spikes in cases. Thankfully, I think it's more than half the cases are under 35. And I'm a big user of the word ignorance. I throw it around a lot. But, you know, I've been having kind of a change of ideas on whether this is ignorant people under 35. Obviously, people have the free will to do what they want. And I think that if people under 35 are going to the beach and they're going out and they're clubbing and they're doing whatever they want, so be it. But don't take it home to grandma. Don't take it home to a little brother or sister that has an autoimmune deficiency. You know, be your own person and take care of yourself and have that responsibility. Obviously, the cases are going to go up and you know, so be it. But if it's going to overwhelm the healthcare system, that's a completely different thing. But if it's just going to be, you know, some people catching something that's not a big deal to them, then I think that in my personal opinion, it might sound off, but I think that it's fine.
And I believe so for a very long time, Damien. I thought that it's best if we open up everything and we tell people that if they're not posing an immediate threat to their family members, that it's okay to go outside and to engage in activities like that. But then I looked online and I saw that places like North Korea and places in Oceania and even Japan, for that matter, and South Korea, they flattened the curve in cases to almost zero, and in some cases, zero cases. And they've returned to normal life like nothing happened. And the reason why is because people have been mandated to wear masks, and they've been mandated to stay home and gone on a nationwide lockdown. So yeah. I think that we've been waiting for a vaccine for a long time, and that I believe very strongly that a vaccine is a solution to the crisis in America. But we also have to understand that there's another solution that we can implement, and that is forcing Americans to stay home for a month or so, or a month and a half, except for essential things, and flatten that curve, actually flatten the curve, instead of saying it's flattened, like he actually said. I was looking it up earlier based on your question, and he said they flattened the curve when they actually haven't, which is misleading and false information.
Yeah.
We have to actually flatten that curve and then tell people it's okay to go outside, because right now it's not. You know, earlier before June, before the cases increased, I was like, the coronavirus is going away, because mm-hmm. all the statistics show that it was going away. The cases were going down, but now they're back up on the rise, and we can't still be promoting the same image. And obviously, upon your point, I do agree. It's everybody's constitutional right to go outside and get themselves infected, but it's not your constitutional right to infect other people, because as we all know, it's an asymptomatic disease in a lot of circumstances.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't know if you had it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm gonna say this. I think that Mike Pence, I can't believe that I'm defending Mike Pence, but we did flatten the curve when we needed to. We didn't completely flatten it, obviously, but we kept it below the line that we needed to for our healthcare system to not get overwhelmed like Italy's did. So I believe that that's what he was referring to. But I'm a strong believer that honestly, everyone should just go outside and everyone should just wear masks.
I
think it was Czech Republic did it, and in 3 weeks they got rid of all their cases, because I don't know, it's just such a stupid thing to me to not wear a mask, to be honest. It's just such a stupid thing, and if we go back to school in August, Rune, I'm gonna wear a mask. And obviously masks aren't meant to protect you, but I don't want to be the person that gets someone else sick, you know. It's just why, if we all did our American our civic duty and wore a mask, we'd just be protecting everyone, and it's common courtesy, and it's something that's already, you know, you mentioned Japan and you mentioned South Korea and you mentioned China. A lot of these people just do it when you feel a cold coming. They just put on a mask because it's courteous, you know. You're trying to protect the people around you, whether they're classmates, whether they're coworkers. And in many cases, something that goes undermined is it's not just coronavirus killing people. The flu was killing people beforehand. And, you know, a sad truth of the flu is that a lot of times, you know, the deaths are with elderly people. But what happens is it's usually the grandkids visiting grandma, and grandkids can barely tell that they're sick, and they're running around. They get grandma sick, and grandma reacts very differently to the flu. And you know, we just need to take a responsibility and look out for each other. And I think that masks have been politicized, and I think that it's gross, and that's where I disagree with Mike Pence completely. Everyone should just wear a mask. I think that it's the manly thing to do. I think that it's the womanly thing to do, and I think that it's the American thing to do.
I can agree with that. I think that it should be mandatory for all of us to wear masks. Obviously, with our presidency, we don't see that as a future for our nation, because even our president doesn't go out and wear masks. and he's supposed to be a representative of all of our people, an elected representative, and he doesn't, you know, push forth that image. And I think that you're right. The Czech Republic has kind of decreased cases to almost at zero. I think they're at zero right now by forcing people to wear masks. And now they're moving towards less mask restrictions and less virus restrictions because they have made that move. And I guess the problem here, and I have to mention it, Mike Pence, during his interview, I saw half of it, I believe, and he said something that kind of caught my eye. He said it's every citizen's constitutional right to go to a Trump rally and to get infected, which I believe is in a sense true. Don't get me wrong.
That's patriotic, but where I don't agree with hell, that, man. I'm gonna get that tattooed on my chest.
Yeah, but I think that where I disagree with that, Damien, is that, you know, it's one thing for people to go out and actively make themselves at risk of exposure, but it's one thing for the president of the United States to go out and mandate rallies and say everybody can come and join these rallies and not put a mask restriction on these rallies of all things.
Yeah.
That should be the most basic thing in these rallies, because we're having thousands upon thousands of people stand like shoulder to shoulder like a basketball game without masks on, and the president is not wearing a mask, saying nothing. So what does that tell the American people? That he doesn't care and that the risk is not real.
Yeah. You know, I tell this to my girlfriend and I bring it up. I tell her, babe, you know, I'm not worried about you getting sick. You know, I know that if you get sick, you'll be fine. What I'm worried about is you, you know, if you go out and you get someone else sick and that person's not fine. You know, thankfully you're strong. You have a strong immune system. You're healthy. But, you know, you don't know who you can get sick. And I think that as Americans, we just need to think about other people more. And I think that I feel bad for people that are put in positions to be role models when they didn't ask for it. For example, musicians oftentimes, you know, they're not asked to be role models. They just want to share their art. And oftentimes they're put in the position of role models. And if they do something wrong, they have to apologize for it. But the president is literally, you know, he says that he's the top law enforcer in our nation. What he also is the top role model for a lot of people, a lot of people. And he needs to take it like that, because I mean, what he's doing right now, it's just immature and it's just stupid. I mean, it's not a politics thing. I don't get what it is. And obviously it's an American's right to get infected. But it's also an American's right to go out and look for each other. You know, you should look out for each other. You should stand arm in arm. And I'd love to see people shopping, and I'd love to see people, you know, getting back to normal behaviors. And it all starts with just everyone wearing masks.
I have to agree. You know, we're seeing malls open up and places open up where we have statistically under 30% of people are actually wearing masks. And that risks not only themselves, but their coworkers and their people around them. So it's a bad kind of situation that we have on a nationwide level. And I'd love to talk with you about this on next week's podcast, next Monday. But I'll, you know, unfortunately, we're nearing the end of our podcast. It's almost 10:35 in Atlanta. So I guess I wanted to end today's podcast, as always, by saying follow us on Twitter at Politatine Show and email us at politatinepodcast@gmail.com with any questions, suggestions, or people to interview for myself and Damien. Once again, we love and appreciate your support on the podcast. And a big, big, big thank you to our research director in Julia Hartman and our graphic design head in Jada Pilling for designing today's podcast graphics, and also for Charles Ravenscraft for joining today's podcast and talking about his campaign. One more thing before we end today's podcast and before we drop the last thing that we have to say is that next week we're having on July 6th, we're having Natalie Bucks go jump on the podcast to describe her campaign for local House of Representatives.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that. And I love having – sorry, were you going to say something you cut out completely
at the end? No, I finished with that.
Oh, okay, I thought you were going to say something else because I saw your little mic move. But no, I'm excited. I, you know, our goal with the podcast was to have people on, and we're having different people on, and I really love it. I'm really enjoying it. I'm enjoying the podcast a ton. You know, I think that we're finally getting to the point where we're practicing what we preach. And that thing that we always preach is go out and have a conversation, go out and have a political conversation, be politically engaged, share your thoughts, speak your truth, and listen to other people. And that's the only way that we're going to create progress here in America. That's what we try to do here on Politatine. I think that we're getting better at it every single week. And we love you guys for tagging along with us and joining us every episode. But with that being said, we want to make sure that you guys have a good rest of your night. Thank you, Varun, for joining me as always.
All right, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politeteen Podcast. As always, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politeteen Show, or to, you know, send us an email at politeteenpodcast@gmail.com to connect with our initiative. And lastly, as always, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our research director at Julia Hartman for inspiring the wonderful content that we present day after day, and to our graphic design director and Jada Pilling for the graphics that illuminate our segments. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of your days.